that God holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as unworthy of nothing else but to be cast into fire. You are 10,000 times so abominable in his eyes as the most hateful and venomous serpent in ours. There is laid in the very nature of carnal men a foundation for the torments of hell.
This quote from Jonathan Edwards' sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, evokes both sadness and anger as it fails spectacularly to reflect the loving heart of God and the inherent value placed upon God's creation. Perhaps no modern church dogma has been more destructive to the mission of Jesus, created more atheists, or generated more religious trauma than that of eternal conscious torment for the non-believer. This podcast's aim is to bring together experts in their fields to take the listener on a historical, philosophical, and theological journey to deconstruct this harmful doctrine. Along the way, the listener will not only be offered pathways to reconstruct a compelling perspective of final punishment, but ways to heal and move beyond the dire impact of eternal conscious torment indoctrination. Thank you for listening as you join us in our journey, the journey towards deconstructing hell. Well, hello, friends, and welcome back to the Deconstructing Hell podcast. This podcast miniseries has been created as a companion to the book by the same title, Deconstructing Hell, Open and Relational Responses to the Doctrine of Eternal Conscious Torment, edited by Chad Ball and published by Sacrosage Press. The show is brought to you in partnership with the Rethinking Faith podcast, hosted by yours truly, Josh Patterson. And today I have joining me the author behind chapter number 15, actually the final chapter of our book, titled Pushed by Fear or Led by Love, and authored by Esther, who I did not ask how to pronounce their last name properly.
So
Esther Getz. All right, there we go. That was my failings. Well, Esther, welcome, and thank you for hanging out today.
Oh, thanks for having me on. This is so
fun. It is fun. This has been a really fun kind of side project. I'm glad that Chad kind of gave me the opportunity to get a talk with all the different authors from the book. It's been so fun, not just you know, kind of reading everybody else's kind of contributions and chapters, but really getting to sit down and talk with the different authors and kind of hear their story, engage with them. And it just kind of has, I don't know, it's made the book more meaningful to me,
right?
Because now I have a face and a story and a person to connect with each chapter. So it's been fun.
Well, here's the question of questions though.
All right.
Who's interviewing you for your chapter?
That is a good question. I believe it will be Chad.
Oh, good.
Yeah. I think Chad is doing it. As far as I know. We'll see. I think, yeah, we've had some conversation. I think we might try to do a like a back-to-back recording where I interview Chad and then Chad interviews me. And then obviously that'll be still two separate episodes, but kind of behind the scenes, it'll be these
that's cool.
One day, deal. Two kind of conversations. Yeah. Cool. Well, Esther, if you wouldn't mind just kind of podcasting 101, if you would introduce yourself to the listeners who might not be familiar with yourself or your work, that'd be awesome.
Oh, sure. So I am Esther Getz, as you said. I am a mom to four grownish and flownish kids, as I call them. They have some significant others. I've been married to the same man for 30 years. So I love doing this stuff. I love podcasting. I am the co-hostess of the Deconstructing Mamas podcast with, sorry about the ding. We're going to edit that out. And I'm going to put myself on Do Not Disturb. Sorry. I'm going to start that again. I am the co-hostess of the Deconstructing Mamas podcast with Liz Enns-Petters. And we've been doing that. We've done three seasons so far, and we're already taping for season four, which has been really fun to get to know a lot of people. We focus on how you do this gig, this deconstructing gig, with also being a parent at the same time. There, we call it walking the tricky tightrope because nobody has grown up. Most people who are in this have not grown up this way. And so what do they do now once they have kids? And aside from that, I am an author. I write under the moniker Esther the Dolly Mama. It's kind of a cute thing. I have a page, and that's really where I'm exploring what it means to be like a human on this crazy faith journey. So I unpack like what it means to be human, what it means to be trying to navigate a more nuanced faith. And I'm also training to be a spiritual director. So there's that.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah. I love the kind of angle that you guys take on the Deconstructing Mamas podcast, because although I personally am not currently a parent, my wife and I, that is something that we both, you know, talk about and have aspirations for. And a conversation that does come up frequently is like, okay, so I don't know. I assume you don't know much about me, Esther, but I used to be a pastor for 6 years. And I left vocational ministry for a variety of reasons. And so like, we have this conversation on a regular basis, like, okay, well, like, what are we going to do when we have kids? Like, I don't know. And so I'm inspired and excited that there are people like yourself, out there, kind of trying to help guide people, along this path. So
yes, you're going to listen to our podcast.
Yeah,
I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing because there has been no resources really, and now there are getting to be more and more resources. So by the time you have kids, there'll hopefully be a lot more. And that was why we did it. We were like, "There's nothing out there. There is nothing out there for parents. So we need to do something." And so you kind of always do what you need. Right? Like, it's like, oh, I need this. Or I certainly needed this. And we have both a young mom and then me as an older mom who's deconstructed, and I have a grandson. And so my daughter is deconstructing as well. And so I did it kind of for her sake. And then Liz is her friend, and she's kind of doing it for her own sake. And so we get to talk to really great people and figure out what the heck they're doing and what do you do now? So it's a good angle. And I just think like, we don't know, this is all new and uncharted territory. We kind of know what we don't want, the same way as say in the deconstructing hell, we know what we don't believe in. We know that we don't necessarily believe in eternal conscious torment for whatever, a variety of reasons, but what do we do now? How do we motivate each other? How do we motivate our kids? How do we motivate ourselves? What is it really all about? So yeah.
Yeah, good deal. I love it. And I love that question of motivation, because I think sometimes, and well, I'll qualify this by saying all aspects of the journey are important. And I had this, you know, specific stage in my own kind of deconstruction journey. I use a different language. I talk about the journey of becoming on
yes!
my show. Yeah.
I love that.
And so, but like, I like the idea of like, what's the motivation? Because it's easy, at least for me. I remember being trapped in this, like, I just want to tear everything down and be angry and jaded and pissed all the time. But then it's like, okay, well, now I have no motivation.
Right.
So I love that language you're using about like, okay, so we did that thing, and that's really important. And it's real, and it's difficult, and it's painful. And it's also probably a continuing journey. But like, how do we have motivation amongst that, or like in the midst of that, or in spite of that kind of thing? So I love that angle. So yeah, that's pretty cool.
It's so funny because we have the podcast Deconstructing Mamas, and I was just at dinner with my husband and my son, and I was like, I don't even love that word, because it sounds more negative. And it's funny that you said the becoming thing, because that's why I've decided to be a spiritual director, because it's like, what do we do? Who are we becoming? And I always say, instead of it's like, not what do I want to get done, it's who do I want to become? That's a very different motivation, where I would say, like, in my past quote unquote faith life, a lot of it was, what do I need to get done? What do I need to get done? And now I feel like my bigger question is, who do I want to become? So you and I, we're on the same page.
Yes, I love it. And I love too the, I don't know how savvy you are to like this realm of things, because it's a little bit more niche, but I like the word becoming, because it fits nicely within process relational thinking. Theology. And that's kind of, yeah, my
a little bit of a nod. Yeah, a little bit. So. Well, and isn't that the way that it should be? Shouldn't we always Absolutely. Be becoming, you know, so, and not ever arriving? I mean, that's where we kind of left. I've kind of left the, I've arrived to, I'm always arriving, and always I became a Christian, and it's like, oh, it's over. It's like, actually I'm becoming, all the time. So never. So that's good. Yay.
Yeah. I love it. I think it reminds me, I think it was Cobb, John Cobb, if not, and it might've been Cobb riffing off, Kierkegaard. Maybe it was just Kierkegaard. I don't know. I'm mixing up people. Forgive me. However, when one of these two figures, when they were asked the question, "Are you a Christian?" They would answer, "No, but I'm becoming one." And I love that answer. I think
love that.
There's something fun there.
Yeah, that's great.
Something kind of inspiring. Yeah, like I'm that's not, good but language. I'm becoming one. I'm working on it. Yeah,
that's good language.
All right. Cool. Well, In regard to the whole deconstructing bit, that's a nice tie into the book Deconstructing Hell that we've mentioned a few times. But one of the questions I've been asking kind of all the authors, just because I'm deeply interested in story and kind of people's backgrounds and the whys behind, what people do. And so I'm just interesting, why did you agree to kind of participate within this Deconstructing Hell project? What was like your motivation for it?
Well, my main motivation was, it was probably the first thing that I started to ask questions about, was hell. Like, I just couldn't wrap my head around. I had been such an evangelist. I mean, that's kind of what my chapter is about. I had been told I had the gift of evangelism. I'm a missionary kid. So my entire world and life was about keeping people out of hell. So hell was talked about all the time growing up. It was just the mission. And then I was told I had the gift of evangelism when I was I think 12. I was told that I'm carrying on the work of keeping people out of hell, you know, all that stuff. So when that came to the forefront, like, it bothered me so much, especially when I had kids, like, I wanted to keep them out of hell. But then I was meeting really great people, like my mother-in-law, who is Catholic. And I was like, she's not going to hell. You know, like, she was so wonderful. And so I had to do so much mental gymnastics around hell. And then I had a friend of mine say to me, "Why do you love hell so much? Like, what is your deal?" And I was like, "I don't know. It's true. And I got to keep people out of it." He was like, "You're so obsessed with it." And that was like a trigger for me. And I was like, yes, wow, I have been almost like, it's been number one in my whole mission in life to keep people out of it. So it's at the forefront of everything I do. So how fun was this that now I've kind of come on the other side of like, nope, this is like the worst, most harmful theology anybody could ever have. I can't imagine a God who would do this. If God does that, I don't even want to go to heaven. To be with that God, like, no thank you. That would be like being with Hitler, you know what I mean? That would be like being with Zeus. That's like being with the worst of the worst. And so once I came to that point, I was like all on board with this. And I asked Chad, I remember, can I write it from a parenting angle? Because really, having my kids, and also, you know, being in the Deconstructing Mamas podcast, having my kids and being terrified all the time that they were going to hell, really was also like, once my friend asked me that and I had remote permission to be like, maybe I don't have to do this parenting gig in absolute terror and fear all the time. And I can do it differently. And it was like, okay, just like almost like a sigh. I was just looking for like a get out of hell free card. So yeah, that was kind of the main motivation. It was like, I finally get to put into words what I've been thinking a lot about this whole hell thing, and especially as it relates to what happened to me in my parenting.
Yeah, I can, again, as I mentioned, I'm not yet a parent. But when I think about even just the people that I love or am closest to, the kind of like existential dread of like, oh, they're going to hell. Like, yes, that's terrifying. And I can, you know, I've been told that like once you have a child, like that really messes with you. And like the kind of affection you have for a child is like no other kind of affection. So I can't imagine kind of the level that kind of raises the stakes to. And I mean, I remember very specifically, there was a person, I won't, you know, use their name because my intent is not to talk shit about people. But somebody I used to look up to within these kind of hell conversations. And then I heard them talking about just a really kind of crazy story that they and their significant other had kind of like pregnancy issues and ended up miscarrying a child, and then essentially espouse some kind of like, oh, well, you know, my child is not with God because they didn't have the ability to be saved and all this kind of thing. And like would use this as a way to be like, oh, God is so good. And so, you know, glory to God. And somehow this person found solstice and peace in this perspective. And I remember it turned me off so much that I was like, absolutely not. And so I think all that to say, I think that parenting angle just kind of brings a helpful, kind of framework to the conversation, because as much as, at least in the tradition I grew up in, being told like experience doesn't matter, don't trust your experience, only trust, you know, the pastor and the word of God, we can't help but have experience,
right? We're human.
And so that, yeah, and that parenting experience I just think is really a helpful kind of framework to bring, because it does like bring this into like a very stark reality.
Right. So I think one of the things that did me in, and my first couple of paragraphs are two stories I tell, one about me as a 9-year-old and then one about my niece as a 9-year-old. But, and I'll leave that to people to read. But another story that really struck me was I had a family member say to me, if it would bring God glory that my child goes straight to hell, God be glorified. And I was like, that's sick. That is sick. Like, no, like how in the world could you think that it's going to bring God glory for your child to be in eternal conscious torment? And I don't know, like you said, it brings people solace. And I'm like, because God is glorified, it brings you solace. Like, that is just weird. Like, I don't know, that just, so it's like all those things where you're like, no, like I would not be happy if somebody was torturing my child. I don't care who they are. Someone is torturing my child and I'm like, good for them, because my child didn't believe in them. So yeah, I get very worked up about the hell idea. I'm an 8 on the Enneagram anyway. So, but still I get like, this is one topic that is very much like, don't get me started. And don't get me started when it comes to the harm, probably to you, to me. Like, you're not a parent, but you have been a child, right? So all of us have been children. And if we've been raised under that kind of eternal conscious torment doctrine, there's just no way that that's not harmful. You're scaring a child, me, you, your future children, my kids. And if that's what God is like, then no, absolutely not. You know, no, thank you. That's like somebody standing over them that is. And I think about me, like I used to say, like, I believed in Santa Claus God, because it was like, he sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good, you'll get coal. But it wasn't coal. It was like, you're going to go to, and right around is the same time that you learn about Santa, you learn about God. It's kind of like this weird thing, and they are very similar when it comes to like the evangelical typical fundamentalist eternal conscious torment God, and then this Santa that watches you and gives you coal if you're not good. It's just a it's just different. One, you maybe can say a magic incantation and get out of it. And the other one, maybe you have to have good behavior in the month of December. So it makes sense. Like, and that's why I say, I don't think you need to be a parent to understand the damage it does to children, because you've been a kid yourself.
Yeah. And I can think back too as well. I kind of grew up at first in a Methodist congregation. And so Methodists tend to be a little bit nicer. This kind of health stuff is a little bit more implicit than explicit, if at all. And then we started going to a Southern Baptist church down the road, where kind of everything changed, because my parents discovered what I like to call the wonders of early 2000s contemporary Christian music. They're like, oh, they're more fun than these Methodist people. So we ended up going there, and that is where I had these more explicit teachings. However, to kind of contradict my own point that I just made there, in the Methodist church growing up, I remember having one experience. I was in fifth grade going through confirmation, and this kind of has always stuck with me. And now I look back and I'm like, that's ludicrous. But I remember being showed a video in confirmation class of these people that were like using a big drill to dig into the middle of the earth. And then they were like, oh, now we're going to drop a microphone down. And so they like lowered it down on this big wire. And then all of a sudden you just heard like screaming and like, you know, like people being tortured and like evil, like, ha, 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 like demon, like clearly today, obviously that sounds ridiculous, but as a fifth grader, it scared the shit out of me.
Yes.
And like, that did something to me, like physiologically, that stuck with me in my body. I remember that. And then also I remember, I was like 9th or 10th grade at the, Baptist church. They brought in this revival preachers.
Yeah.
And this revivalist guy came through and he told the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Oh, and I was like, oh, that's a cool story. Right. But the way he ended it was, he was like, you guys won't be as lucky as they are. You're all going to burn in the furnace. And we're like, what? You flipped this story. And so those are the two kind of like childhood memories that I can, you know, just kind of bring to mind immediately, that like genuinely, as, you know, looking back again, I can laugh at them. But in those moments, that was terrifying stuff that had long lasting ramifications that took me a long time to kind of get over.
Right. Yeah. And that, I guess I think like if people can get to your amygdala and get it on fire, right, they can just make you scared to death. And then they have the answer for you. That it's kind of like a friend of mine said, it's kind of like a big giant sales pitch. We're going to scare you to death. And then we'll be like, hey, we have the answer. Just do this one thing. And then come to our church. It's like, oh, that's kind of like what everybody does out there. That's just an advertising gimmick. And that's, it works. It definitely works. I mean, fear works. So in the short term, but it's so harmful. I mean, there's good fear too, but I'm just saying that the toxic fear, you know, like scaring a child who's 5 to death, you know, because they're going to be, you know, sent to eternal conscious torment, somehow doesn't seem like that's a good thing you should do to children. But I did it. I did it with mine. So, I mean, I'm horrified at myself. And I also have to give grace to myself. I'm horrified and giving grace and tender and all. So.
No, I think that's so good. I love the language of, you know, because I look back on like past versions of Josh and I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you did or said those things. And even like I look back on past versions of Josh that exist on Rethinking Faith podcast, like you can go back on the feed and hear it. And I'm like, oh, I hope no one ever listens to that episode ever again. But kind of something that I worked in, you mentioned how you're working to become a spiritual director. But one thing that a spiritual director helped me with was coming to this realization that like, hey, you have to have grace for past versions of Josh. Yes, yeah. And then also recognizing being able to have grace for past versions of myself, that also helps me recognize when I see something in somebody else that I don't like. It's like, okay, I'm this could be a projection of past versions of Josh, and that's why I'm so upset right now. So I can have grace for that person as well. So like that was a really kind of helpful thing for me to walk through. So I like that you bring that up.
Yeah, it's so important that we have to forgive and be tender with former versions of ourselves. It's one of the hardest things, but it does. Somebody who's maybe not as all the people who still believe in hell, I'm like, okay, I can have grace for you because you're scared and you're just doing what I would have done. Like my past self would have loved you. And so then it does. Grace begets grace, which is really good.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I guess I'm going to be a bummer and shift from the positive fun talk of grace and dive back into fear.
Yeah.
Because kind of what you do in your chapters, you kind of set up like this kind of fear and love kind of thing going on. And so you kind of make this claim that fear is the root of this kind of doctrine of eternal conscious torment. And then you kind of list out like five different fears. And I thought maybe it could be fun to kind of walk through those and maybe just hear like a little bit from you on each of those, maybe how that impacted you or like what you had in mind when you like started talking about those fears. And then we'll flip and go happy again. But let's we can start with fear. So one of the fears that you mentioned that you think is kind of tied into this doctrine of eternal conscious torment is the fear of death. So tell us a little bit about this, the fear of death.
Yeah. So one of the things I think, and I wrote this in the chapter as well, was that idea, that verse in the Bible about the wages of sin is death. And I think I memorized that when I was just a young tot, right? One of the first verses that you ever remember. And of course, the second half is the gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. But somehow the emphasis was on the fear of death. And so you're constantly living with what is going to happen to me when I die. Somehow the end of life is the most important thing. And fear about the end of life becomes the most important thing. Like you don't even get to live now in the present because you're always concentrating on death. And then you're thinking about other people dying. What about their death? And then your responsibility about their death. So instead of life being what God has given us, it's somehow death is the highest, most important topic to always talk about, research. And you do have fear because you're a human being. And you're going to have this crazy fear of death. But then it's like, yeah, so then I say at the core of the doctrine of eternal conscious torment is one of the big things is the root is fear. So you have fear of death. Where am I going when I die? Words like, if you were to die tonight, would you know where you were going? I mean, how many preachers, how many revival meetings, how many, like, you could get hit by a bus when you walk out the door. Do you know where you'll spend eternity? So it just was always talked about. And it does become like the focus. As soon as my kids were born, I started to worry about where they were going when they died. It wasn't like, hey, what are they going to do tomorrow, you know, when they're at their basketball game? It's like, did they ask Jesus into their heart yesterday? So yeah, that was kind of where I was going with the fear of death.
Yeah, it adds like this, it's like already to be human is to like have this, you know, this existential kind dread. Of dread and fear of death. But then it's like makes that kind of human experience a little bit more nefarious. It like kind of capitalizes on that human experience is like, well, not only are you going to die, but also like there's this whole hell thing and that part sucks really bad too.
Right. So it's exactly. Kinda like, that's actually worse. That's yeah. Worse than physical death. And you're already afraid of physical death because you're, we joke all the time in our house, we're so fragile. I mean, like right now I could be sitting here and a lightning bolt could come out and crack, you know, I could die on this podcast. So you already do have that swirling around always as just a human being. So then you're just adding on like, oh, guess what? You're going to have eternal death after that. <It's> exhausting.
Absolutely exhausting. And then, on top of that exhaustion, another fear kind of gets added. So not only do we have the fear of death, but then we also have the fear of abandonment by God. So where do you see this abandonment by God playing into this kind of conversation?
Yeah, I think about like, I guess related even to kids. If you tell a kid that they're separated from God, like I also, one of the very first things I read was the Four Spiritual Laws, that lovely tract. And there's this huge chasm between you and God. And so I think like a child or all of us as people, we're designed to connect. We're designed to not be separated. And then you're told right away that you're separated because of your sins. So then you're like, God has sort of bailed on you. There's this big thing that's between you and God, this big gulf. I mean, and then somehow there's this magic cross that lays down. I mean, and some people try to get over there on their own and they can't quite get to God. And so there's this always this like, not only do you're afraid of dying, but like while you're here, you're abandoned by God. Like until you do this thing, you're abandoned. And like I think about core fears for people, and abandonment is one of them. It's just a major core. Rejection and abandonment are like two core fears that you're hopefully always trying to heal from. And this is just saying, yep, guess what? You're separated. You are separated at birth from your parents, from God. Sorry. So yeah, that's kind of where I was going with it. It plays into humanity's core fears.
Yeah, and that, as you just kind of mentioned, ties into one of the other fears you lay out, which is this fear of separation from those that we love.
Oh my goodness. So, and if I go into the parenting thing, like a kid's greatest fear, and when they're really little, is that they're separated from their parents. That's called separation anxiety. They want to know they're safe. Are their parents there? Will they make it? Will they come back for them? And I think, I tell the story of my niece. She, when her mom died, she was like 9. She came into my room crying and she was just like, I'll never see mommy again. And they're from a very, very conservative, like, I think it's Reformed, Calvinistic, where it's God's will that mommy died. And she was just freaking out. Like, what if I'm not one of the elect? And I was like, this is not okay. So now you have the fear of separation from those you love. So you're going to go to hell and maybe your parents are in heaven. Or if you go to heaven, guess what? Some of the people you love are in hell. Like it's never good. I mean, it's like if you're in heaven and then somehow there's this like magical, well, in heaven, it won't matter that some of your people went to hell. I mean, what? It just screws with our brains. And again, it taps into the fear of being separated again. So from God, from people we love, everything that is supposed to feel safe for us as humans, God and others, it's supposed to feel safe. And instead it feels terrifying.
Yeah. I a story comes to mind. I remember, it's kind of an infamous story, but, It kind of a common trope or thing that apparently, if I'm getting it correct, I believe it was R.C. Sproul. But if it's not Sproul, I apologize, Sproul. But I'm pretty sure it's R.C. Sproul. In class, student would ask like, basically like, oh well, like how can I, if I'm in heaven, how can I be happy and enjoy heaven if I know that my grandmother is in hell? And Sproul's answer, that's kind of infamous, was like, oh well, like when you're in heaven you will be worshiping and praising God at the glory that is your grandmother suffering in hell, and the only reason that you don't see that right now is because you're a tiny puny human and you don't understand. But it's like, that makes no sense.
I just don't understand. I can't even watch, and I like first I like crime shows and whatever, I'm okay with a dead body, but torture to me, like I can't handle that. Like I can't handle watching that. So like, how in the world are we supposed to be pleased with someone being tortured, and especially forever, and especially someone we love? That just, you're right, it makes absolutely zero sense. And I think like for me, it's the greatest, like to hold that over a child is one of the greatest forms of harm and abuse and manipulation. Like, oh, you don't want to be separated from your mommy or your daddy or grandma. You better say this magic prayer to keep you out of there. But somehow grandma died and she didn't believe in God. So sorry, get over that. Or even I think about, this is a terrible, but I remember being at a church camp and a friend of mine's like dad wasn't a Christian. And she was flipping out at like the church camp throw the stick in the fire, that her dad, she was like 12, was not going to heaven. And here she was at a church camp and just sobbing. And like the counselors didn't know what to say to her. But like, that is just like, that just really feels like abuse and harm at this point. Like, why are you telling someone that their dad is going to go get be tortured forever? And that it's her responsibility then to, she's responsible for that. She needs to go home and get her dad saved. And then she doesn't have control of her dad. So yeah, it's just, I just see all this as terrible.
Yeah, well, I'll wrap up the negative fear talk too by kind of tying these last two together, which is like kind of the fear of punishment that comes with eternal conscious torment, also the fear of this like endless pain and suffering.
Yeah, I feel like just in society, we constantly use rewards and punishment to get what we want. And I do feel like, again, this doctrine of hell plays into people's core fears of, pain, suffering, torture, and then it's endless, add that on, and then being punished. And you can get people, you can hold a gun to someone's head and get them to do what you want. But does that really learn to real true transformation and change from a good place? Does it lead to wholeness and healing and life and joy and peace? I don't think so. It's short. It's a short term. It does work, but it's short term. And again, I would say if I watched anybody doing that in any other venue except for religion, I would be like, run for the hills. But we do that in religion all the time. And somehow it's widely accepted that it's okay. It's not a, and that's how I lived. I mean, that's what I did. That's what I knew. And that's how I parented. And that's kind of how I treated myself, my friends, everybody around me. You know, because I guess the last thing is that I thought, well, it's better for me to make them afraid now so they'll be safe later. I guess that was the mindset.
Yeah, and I think that's that kind of juxtaposition of the now and the later, I think is really important in kind of the hell conversation overall. Because, I mean, you kind of said like, you know, they'll be safe later. But what's interesting about that idea, if I like take that out of the parenting context and then let's place it into just like the larger society and, right, and the world, when you have that kind of perspective, that's like a really great way to oppress people, because you can say like, oh, well, like, yeah, being a slave right now, I'm sorry, that sucks. But guess what? In the afterlife, way better. So it's kind of it. Yeah, it just seems that's not good.
Like, no, and it minimizes suffering now as well.
It does.
It minimizes, it's like, oh, okay, so what if you're afraid your whole life? So what if you're a sufferer your whole life? So what if you're in pain? It really just minimizes and diminishes now. And it minimizes so much that's evil and not good that's going on now. And I say the hell that's going on now. And I think our job, I always say, is to bring some up there, down here, on earth as it is in heaven. Like, our job kind of is to eliminate suffering as much as we possibly can, eliminate people's hell now. And so if we're adding to people's hell now by making them terrified, that just doesn't seem like it's good. Seems bad. Good, bad. I mean, and I'm not a big like black and white thinker, but it doesn't feel whole or good or wonderful or beautiful. It does feel harmful to me. Very harmful. Very destructive.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like, if even if you want to bring in like a little bit more Christianese language to the conversation, you know, when you think about something like the fruits of the spirit,
yes.
Then it's like, okay, what is the fruits of this doctrine of hell? It produces fear. It produces anxiety. People go to therapy. You know, like Mark Karras has a new book out. All about hell. It's called like the Diabolical Trinity. It's not actually about the Trinity, but it's about right, like three different kind of ideas, like eternal conscious torment, worm theology, and I forget what the third one is. Forgive me, Mark. But yeah, like that, the psychological, my point is the psychological ramifications are bad.
Yes, bad.
Demonstrably bad. Like, we have studies on it. There's like the hell anxiety scale, and people like Dan Coker are researching spiritual harm and trauma and abuse. And it's a very real phenomenon. So it's like, okay, well, if Jesus talked about, like, I came to give you life and life everlasting and also the fruits of the spirit, well, none of this really sounds like that. So
right.
Maybe it's grounds to kind of question some things.
Right. Yeah. I just think, like, is it producing all, like you said, the fruits of the spirit? And I just don't see it. I didn't see it in my own life. I didn't really see it in the lives of the people around me. And I'm kind of like, go back to what Jesus is like, hey, by the fruit, you will know them. So. If fear is your goal, well, if good behavior is your goal, then fear is the way to do it. But I don't think good behavior is the goal. I think inner transformation and healing in life is the goal. So that's where I say, like, my chapter of being pushed by fear or led by love, maybe to segue us into the happy part. You know, when we're pushed by fear, it's not just parenting. It's every single part of your life. You got to ask your question all the time. Am I being pushed by fear? And I'm not talking about normal fear of, like, moving your hand from the stove and, you know, not jumping off a cliff or whatever. I'm not talking about things that keep you alive, because that would also not, that's kind of the point of it. I'm talking about toxic, you know, damaging fear, anxiety, dread, all that kind of stuff that's really harmful. Making people terrified so that you can, with an end goal in mind of something supposedly wonderful. And it is hard. You do have to uncouple those, because a lot of times people are like, well, I'm really afraid for the people I love. I'm like, yeah, but that's probably because we've been conditioned to think that fear and love, just like we've been conditioned to think that violence and love go together, that fear and love go together. And I've moved to uncouple those things now.
Yeah. Because you, within your chapter, share, like, a lot of, like, personal story and narrative, which is one of my favorite things about your chapters, just the personal aspect. But you kind of talk about, like, how these kind of ideas of fear impacted your parenting. You've mentioned that a couple times during this conversation already, but experientially for you, where do you kind of remember where that shift started to happen for you, from moving out of this, okay, I'm done being pushed by fear, what does it look like to now be led by love? Like, where did that shift kind of start to happen for you?
Yeah, I would say it began. I have my fourth child. We call her unconditional love in a body. It was almost like this. We call it, like, before Rachel and after Rachel. It's a very strange thing. I guess I still believe in kind of miracles, but whatever. It was a real big shift for me, leaning into vulnerability with her. For whatever reason, didn't happen with my first three kids, but it did happen because she just was such a vulnerable kid. And, like, she was the kid that was, like, crying if I yelled, or, you know, all those things. And something weird happened. And what happened then over time, was that I began to love my people, and I would say my children, more than I loved the doctrine of hell. Does that make sense? Like, I began to love my people more than my theology. Like, it was like, if this theology, and I think even somebody like Jen Hatmaker said, and I heard it again today, if it's not true for everyone, then it can't be true for anyone. And she was like, if it's not true for the single mom in Haiti, then it's not true. And I was reading one of Jen Hatmaker's probably fairly evangelical books at the time, but it was those little things. And I was like, if it's not true for a 5-year-old, then it's probably not true for a 35-year-old, right? Or a 55-year-old. And if God is too scary for a 5-year-old, then there must be something wrong with my view of God. I talked about hell with my other kids, they were fine. And then she just, like, I don't know, like, that was just not okay. Like, there was, like, nightmares and all. So, like, those are the kind of things. So I was like, I think love might be. And also I started to see, like, at church, the use of fear and guilt. And then I had, you know, my teenagers were like, that's not going to work on me, guilt. That's not good. And they're going to public school, realizing that fear and guilt is not good. And I have to say, public school is probably really good. Because my kids would come home and be like, nah, mom, that's not the way to do it. You know, we don't do that. They don't do that anymore. And so just starting to see it everywhere and realizing there has to be a better way. And plus for me, when I went through a really major crisis, the people who were unconditionally loved me, like that's what really changed me. It wasn't really all that fear and guilt and everything. That was short term. So, you know, experientially, I say, like my favorite story that I read and that I wrote in the book was I asked my daughter, would God be more glorified if like a single, if a crackhead mom like had a baby, would God be more glorified? I was still in the evangelical. If the baby went to heaven or if the crack mom went to heaven. And she was like, isn't God big enough and loving enough to like have them both go? And I was like, yeah. You know, like it just, so she just kept asking and asking. And so it was not really helpful. And it just did. She started to change. When you're unconditionally loved, no matter who it is, it starts to change you. It just starts to change you. It's just such a weird thing. And so I just started to be like, well, what am I? And I read a book and that was the question that was asked of me. Am I being pushed by fear or led by love? And I looked at my life and reflected and said, I think I'm being pushed by fear and it needs to be going in a different direction. Having teenagers helps with that too. You're just trying to battle the fear monster all the time and you don't have control and it's good. And you can just move into a place of being led by love then. Yeah. And for me, being led by love means getting rid of agendas for everybody else. And my agenda of keeping people out of hell had to go. And I watched people, like I watched our church try to say like, we love with no strings attached. And then like, we did, and I was like excited, but then there was like strings as soon as you wanted to serve or as soon as, you know, you wanted, I don't know. It was like, but there was still like the get them here so we can tell them the gospel, but we'll love them with no strings attached, but it wasn't true. So, yeah.
Yeah, that, I love the point that you just made about, and you said it's kind of strange, like unconditional love brings transformation. But I mean, I think even from psychological perspective, within like documented case study and stuff, it is just true that shame and guilt and fear do not bring change and transformation in someone's life, but it's actually unconditional love. Belonging and acceptance.
Yes.
So when people know that they belong as they are for who they are, like unconditionally, that fosters an environment for change. And I'm not talking about like using this in a manipulative way where you're like, oh, well, like I'm going to pretend to accept gay people so then I can change them. Like, no, that's what I'm talking about. Cause then that's not genuine unconditional love and acceptance.
Exactly.
But that kind of unconditional love gives people permission to change it. It brings out the best in everybody. And so I love that. I love that point. And I think it's one that a lot of, I don't want to say all, I'm trying to work, you know, stay away from using overly generic language, but I think a lot of churches or a lot of churches that look like the kind of church I grew up in could learn something about unconditional love. And they might just be a little bit surprised how that works compared to the fear and anger.
Right. But I think it's hard. I think it, that unconditional love requires a lot of taking ownership of your own stuff, your own fears, your desire to control, because that's, if especially if you're raised with fear and then obviously it's best friend of control. It's hard to change because fear and control produce results quickly. And that's a very Western mindset. We need things immediately and quickly, where unconditional love takes it is painstaking long. It takes a lot of reflection and it takes trusting the process to play out over time. And so our knee-jerk reaction is to just use fear and guilt. And it's so funny because I have 20 somethings now. And they're, as soon as I'll go into like using a little guilt, like your grandma's dying, you should go see her. They're like, Mom, you say like no guilt, look at you. And I'm like, sorry. Because you know, it's just our natural default, right? It's very, very hard to, and much more work to use, to lean into nuance and curiosity and acceptance and, you know, doubt, all those things that love requires, you know, like, and not having all of the things that we don't necessarily feel safe inside. It's scary to love someone unconditionally. And so what happens is your fear, and then you're like, control. Oh, there's that fear again. So then we are afraid. So then we just use fear. It's just, it's such a, but then when you see it over time, like I've seen my relationship with my people, my kids, my partner, friendships, my own treatment of myself, giving myself unconditional love, which is the hardest person of all. And you can watch a slow, beautiful transformation over time. And then you're like, oh, this is what everybody's talking about. Right? This is, oh, I get it now. Oh, okay. Yeah. I would rather be like the person that my kids love being around than the mom who's just guilting their kids and they come over for Christmas or some random holiday because they're being forced to. That's the kind of God that I grew up with. And that's not the kind of God I want to portray or be involved with. And that's not the kind of person I want to be. I want people to have freedom to be with me because I love them. Like, you want to be with people who love you and accept you for who you are. Like, that's who I want to be around.
Yeah, that I love it. That ties nicely into like kind of these. We don't have to go through all of them, but I'll hit a few of them. Just kind of these like new axioms, inspired by this God who is love. That is like, okay, yeah, actually, that God sounds like somebody I want to be around. Which I love that too, because that was part of my story. So, for me, when I first started doing spiritual direction, and my spiritual director was inviting me into like contemplative practice and all this kind of stuff. First off, I thought it was weird. I was like, what is this hippie shit you're trying to teach me? And then on top of that, I was like, but also you're asking me to like get up close and personal with this God that I'm afraid of. I don't want to know that guy. Like, he's scary. And probably is just going to be angry at me, kind of thing. And so it took a long time. Like, Sid, my spiritual director, she really helped walk with me. And she allowed me to be honest about my thoughts and feelings and express why I was not comfortable doing these things. And then also that paired with started, because I'm kind of like a more head-centric person. I live in my brain. And so then kind of finding different theologies or ways of speaking or different ways of characterizing God that intellectually allowed me to affirm a God who is love, then kind of paired nicely with Sid and the work that I was doing with Sid, because I think that experiential aspect is really what kind of pushes somebody over. Yes. Not just ideas, because it moves out of the realm of ideas into this experiential embodied knowledge. And now, like, I mean, I fancy myself a mystic. Like, I do the weird hippie contemplative practices all the time. Like, that's my thing. And I'm, you know, that has introduced me to a God who is love. Right. And so I don't know. I love that, that kind of idea that you know, talking about, being around somebody who is unconditionally loving and just kind of the to use some more process language, the divine lure that kind of
the divine lure that offers. That. Yeah. Oh my gosh, I like that.
Yes. Yeah.
That's so good. And I do think, like, I just, when you were talking about that, about I did not ever like, quote unquote, like having quiet time, because I why are you going to want to be with somebody that you're just going to go and they're going to tell you, my friend says most sermons and most quiet time is like, God is good, you're not, stop it. Like she goes, that's any sermon. God is good. You're not, stop it. And so like, who wants to be there? Like, I was like, why are all these other people okay with having this quiet time? I go to that quiet time and I'm like, oh my gosh, I just suck as a human once again. God's kind of mad at me. I better pull myself up by whatever bootstraps I don't have and make some charts for myself to be better. And it just doesn't, it just didn't work. And now I the other day I was like, wow, have I prayed for a while? I do breath prayers and stuff like that, but I'm like, I was like, I'm okay with it. Who cares? Like, it just didn't matter because it's not like I'm separated from God. He's mad at me. She's mad at me. Whatever you want language, they're mad at me. It just feels like, oh my gosh, a big sigh for my soul. And I think that's this whole thing of like the doctrine of hell and getting rid of it. It is like a giant inhale of love and exhale of like, phew, all right. I can just like live as a person, love other people, be my, you know, try to discover who I am, like become, like you said at the beginning, become the best version of myself as I'm always arriving, love others with no agenda, and trust the process. And my husband said to me, I think, I don't know if this is a quote from Richard Rohr or something, like, we've come from love, we're held in love, we'll return to love. And then I just get to be. And that's very much what I hope, like as I become a spiritual director, as I finish my course, you know, and I become one, I like, yeah, just letting people be where they are. And what did you call it? The lure? I like that.
The divine lure. Yeah. Exactly. Because right. Within the process and relational framework, like God is like non-coercive. So God's power is not a power that relies on force and coercion, but rather is one of uncontrolling and unconditional love, like you're talking about. And so it's the lure of God, that divine love is what, you know, calls us into a more beautiful future kind of idea. So it's
yeah,
I love it.
That's a Thomas Ord thing.
Yes. Thomas J. Ord, very much so.
yeah, I love that. And you know what's funny? As you said, lore, I was thinking like the bait and switch of like the other side of like, hey, we're going to lure you. And then we have this hook, which is very different. It's like, no, it's more just like, hey, invitational instead of coercive. So that's beautiful. Love that.
Yeah, no hooks in this camp. More so. Just like, hey, so the world could be way more beautiful and loving and kind and accepting. Do you want to be a part of that?
Yay,
sure,
I
let's
do.
Do it. Yeah.
I do want to be.
There's that kind of, yeah, that the divine lore of the, forgive me for, you know, waxing theologically, but the God who is present in and through all things, in all moments, seeking to bring about goodness and beauty and love. In every moment has an invitation for each and every one of us. We have the option to give into that divine lure, the divine call into the things that are good and beautiful and true. And I'm like that. Okay. Now there's a vision. Now there's a thing that I can get on board with.
Right.
Because well, again, it's back to your point. It's that unconditional love and acceptance. Hop on. Kind of thing.
Well, and I think too is why wouldn't, like, we are attracted, and we, like, studies show, just my own personal life shows, that when I feel like I belong before I behave, like I'm accepted before, you know, I act, all those things, like, and I'm loved before I do or whatever, I just want to be part of that. It's a harder path and not an easy, like, quick path, like I said earlier, but it's so much better and it's so much more transformational. And I mean, I hate to say this, and I'm so happy about this, and God bless my kids for still loving me and forgiving me, but I do have a fantastic relationship with my 20 somethings. And I just think, like, I have made a commitment to them that I want to be the person that they, when they walk into a room, they feel better when they leave, you know, when they leave me than when they came in. And my mother-in-law has always done that for me. And I could be with her all day long. And that's just what I want to be. And there's like no agendas. And that's the way I view God now. It's like the God without agenda, which is really, really, really much better. I do want to spend time with that one. Well, plus I feel like she intertwined with me anyway, and I'm not separated. And when I spend time with myself, I feel like I'm spending time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I love that. That was one of like the axioms you kind of brought out, was like, I'm not and never will be abandoned by God, which I very much love. I kind of found that for myself first within the mystics, not just in Christianity, but mystics across the kind of religious spectrum. They all kind of seem to speak that way. But then even within like, I keep bringing it up, so forgive me, but like within my process relational framework, like separation from God is metaphysically impossible. Yeah. And so whenever, you know, we feel separated from God, it's not that we actually are, it's actually, it's an illusion that we're kind of buying into. Yeah. And so I love that.
Right. Yeah. I always use the thing of like, there's $1 million in the wall and you didn't know. And you were rich, but you thought you were poor. And that's kind of how it is. Like, you think you're separated from God, or you've been told you're separated from God. I wonder if we were never told that, what we would actually believe. I wonder if we would just naturally, as children, believe we were not. It'd be fun to, you know, but to undo all that and uncouple that and say, actually, I'm not. That's like probably the mission of a lifetime. is to not believe we're separated from each other, God, the world that we live in, that we are actually one. And we are, right? That's like, I mean, I'm like thinking about the 70s rock and roll artists. We're like, come on, people, now, you know, we're got to get together and the world, you know, make the world right now. I just love each other right now, because it's just true. It's true. I'm a mystic, Mike Morrell, who I interviewed a couple months ago on our podcast, he calls himself an optimistic. And I love that. I'm like, oh, and my spiritual direction group that I'm in with at the Hayden Institute, we stole that from Mike. I asked him, can we call our group the optimistics? Yeah. So that's good.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Mike is an awesome dude.
Yeah, he is pretty good guy.
Yeah, Mike was at a beer camp, theology beer camp last year.
Even though I don't like beer, maybe we'll just have to come.
There's people who don't drink beer, and as I am being informed, there is going to be non-beer options this year, by popular request. So wow. There will be other things as well included in beer camp.
That's good. That's great.
Yeah. So again, giving into the divine lure to go to theology beer camp. But anyway, I'll just pick up on one thing that you said, because it has been a huge, just one of the big insights and kind of life changing and truly transformational things for me, is something that you mentioned, which is recognizing that we're not separate from one another, that we're not separate from God, we're not separate from creation. And we're also not separate from ourselves, which I think is a big one. And I think part of why that's so important for me is I kind of now see or talk about sin as something that arises out of this illusion of separateness. Because when I believe I'm separate from you, then I can dehumanize you. I can be racist. I can, you know, cause you harm, etc. If I believe I'm separate from the earth, then, well, climate change. If I believe, you know, that I'm separate from God, we fall into this whole kind of conversation that we've been having, these negative ramifications of hell. And then when you believe you're separate from yourself, which I think is one of the greatest sicknesses that our world has today, is the proof is in the pudding. Just look at the world today. But kind of once you recognize that, these things are deeply interconnected, then things that Jesus said, like, what you do unto the least of these, you do unto me, start to make a lot more sense.
right, because it's like, of course, like, because Jesus is one of the one another's. I mean, it's part of the interconnectedness, which is just really cool. That does make a lot of sense. I like that. I'm gonna write that on my notes, take that home with me. I like that. That does make a lot more sense. I do like what you're saying about the probably the best place to start is to be connected to yourself. And that,
yeah,
probably why I'm becoming a spiritual director, because I hope to have people do that. And I think, like you said, what your spiritual director did for you, and we alluded it to earlier, even connected to our past selves and having grace for them. And then I always say, and we say this on our podcast, our little mantra is grace for who you were and who you are now, and then space for who you're becoming. And we do need that. We do need the space. We need to be connected to our future self, like allow room for that future self to change. And you were joking at the beginning, like you're almost mortified at what you said on your own Rethinking podcast. As a writer, I'm like, oh no, oh, I posted that a year ago. But then I'm like, oh, well, that was a part of me who was trying to figure it out. We're always in the figuring it out. So all of it matters. I was still in the figuring it out in the past, and I'm still in the figuring out. And 5 years from now, I'll probably look back at this conversation and be like, oh my gosh, hopefully I'll know more deeply what's real and true about myself, others, and God, and how we're all interconnected. I hope so. I want to leave room for that. And then that person will have to forgive this person, which it's so great. I just think about my like 75-year-old self, like holding my hand and being like, come along, it's okay. We're doing this together. So we've done it together. And yeah, that's cool. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's just like, I don't know. I love that. It's like, I don't know. I got an image like thinking of myself, like you're saying, like 75-year-old Josh being like, look, dude, you were doing the best you could with what you knew at the time. And like, good job. It's all good.
Job.
Relax, breathe, and like, let's go have some fun.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I know. I do these weird things like write letters to my future and former. So I do that all. I do that as part of writing. I have 4 letters in my closet of, in 3 years from now, I have 4 of us friends. We wrote letters to ourselves in 10 years, and we're going to open them 3 years from now. And I am like weirded out. It's like sealed in my closet. I'm like, what was I like 7 years ago? I'll probably be mortified. It'll be great though. That's good. It's good stuff. It's all us, and it's all part of us, and it all matters. So.
Absolutely. That reminds me, I'll throw this one more thing your way. As you're talking about those letters, it reminded me of looking back. My wife and I watched our wedding video recently. And we're coming up on 7 years married this year. And listening back to our wedding vows, some of the language that we were using, we were like, holy crap. Like, I didn't even know I could talk that way. Or it's like today, I was like, I would never use, like, you know, I don't, not to belittle it, but just like this, like deeply like Christianese, like very, what's the word? Not trite, but like cliche kind of ways of speaking. And I'm like, oh my goodness. But then like also being able to laugh together and like recognize like, wow, but like then like we meant that, like that was still real and like and very true, and you know, whatever, and being able to laugh at that, and then just kind of like, I don't know, like renew, not like we went through a vow renewal ceremony or something like that, but just like, I don't know, watching that felt it like it did something. It was cool, like accepting that together, cool. Laughing, and then like bringing that love into now. So.
Yeah, that's cool. But. Yeah, my daughter's married 7 years, and she also got married and like. She just thinks like she they're coming up on 7 years next couple weeks, or I think next week. She's just like, oh my gosh, we were so young and we were so Christian. It's like the 3 chords that are not easily broken. The 3 strands. I mean, and it is cute. It's fun. It's part of life to just, you know, like part of loving your former self is to laugh.
Absolutely. That's great. Absolutely. Well, Esther, is there any, maybe like final thoughts or like concluding, I don't know, not doxology, wisdom, something. Yeah. You would like to impart for our listeners as we kind of wrap up this conversation today.
Right. Well, I guess the last thing, if I do kind of turn into a spiritual director for a minute, I think that that is a question I would ask and have people ask of themselves just in their lives and like in their beliefs and even just in their everyday is, you know, am I being pushed by fear or led by love? And a lot of times you can really begin to feel it in your body. Like whatever decision is in front of you, whatever beliefs, like if you're triggered in church, like even just, or you're triggered wherever you are in something you're reading or something you're doing or a decision you have to make, it's like, wow, is this coming from a place of love where I'm like being led, like you said, like lured or allowing myself to be lured into this love or, you know, pulling others into love where it's either me being lured or me luring others into that, you know, unconditional love, or is it really fear? Is it fear-based? And you can feel it in your body, and then you can watch it in the next, very next decision that you make. Like you'll feel in your body, like where everything goes hot, or I would say too, or if you hear something and you're highly triggered by it, or if you're moving to a place of control, I think that's another, that's like the, or if you're like, if you find yourself in a restful, peaceful place, it's probably much, you know, a different, you're probably being more led by love. If it's bringing, like you said, the fruits of the spirit of joy, peace, love, you know, harmony, wisdom, all those things, gentleness, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, you know, so yeah. But I do like, that's a question I've asked myself and I ask myself almost every day. And so that's why I made the choice. After that title. So, yeah,
good. Well, good deal. This was a lot of fun. Even though we talked a lot about fear, I feel like it was wrapped in love, and we did a lot of laughing, and I think that's always a good thing. So I appreciated the conversation. Thank you so much for your contribution to deconstructing hell and to the work you do with Deconstructing Mamas. And so yeah, like listeners, go check it out if you haven't already. Right. And then is there anywhere else that maybe you'd want to point our listeners if they're like, I need more Esther, where can we go?
Yeah, I have a website, estherjoygetz.com. But really, if they want more Esther, I am on Esther the Dalai Mama on both Instagram and Facebook. And I have a newsletter that is every week. It's called Soulful Sundays. And it is really leans into like more of the spiritual direction stuff. I call it a room for your soul to breathe. And so that's where it is. But it's, yeah, you can find it all on my website. So, yeah.
Sweet. Perfect. Well, thanks for sharing that info with us. Listeners, there you go. Go check out some fun things. And also, if you haven't done so already and you've been enjoying this podcast, the Deconstructing Hell book is pretty cool.
It
not just
cool.
Saying that because we've contributed, but also maybe kind of.
Coolest cover ever. Coolest
yes.
Cover ever of any book ever. And really good stuff inside.
Yeah, I agree. And
I loved your chapter, Josh. I loved your chapter. Shout out for Josh's chapter.
maybe one day we'll get an interview for Josh's chapter. We'll see.
Thanks so much, Josh.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you, Esther, and listeners. Thanks so much for hanging out, guys. And as always, go in peace.